Hello, and welcome back to the Structural Engineering Podcast. This week, we're stepping beyond beams and columns and into the world of long spans, lightweight systems, and expressive structures. In this episode, we're talking with Joshua about space frames, cable nets, and ETFE membrane systems, structural solutions that challenge conventional load paths and push engineers to think three-dimensionally. We'll explore how these systems work, where they shine, and the unique analysis, detailing, and constructability considerations that come with them. From stadium roofs and airport terminals to auditoriums and iconic enclosures, these systems blur the line between structure and architecture and demand a high level of collaboration and creativity from structural engineers. If you've ever wondered when a space frame makes sense, how cable nets actually carry load, or why ETFE has become such a powerful tool for large enclosures, this episode is for you. So let's get started.
The Structural Engineering Podcast.
Thanks for having me on and excited to just be here and chat with you. So right now I'm sitting in my office at Gonzaga University. So I'm a structural engineering professor, wannabe architect. So my background is architectural engineering and then structures. Before we headed out to Washington State, I was a practicing engineer with two firms in particular that really shaped me. The first, of course, is Skidmore, Owings & Merrill. And so I worked in the Chicago office there. And then the big one, and especially in the context of today, is Studsky Engineering. So did a lot of niche kind of lightweight architecture and structures. And, you know, I think where that really comes from is growing up, I wanted to be an architect. That's a pretty common thread among kindred spirits here. And so wanted to be an architect, didn't really know, you know, what all that looked like. And then I found this thing called architectural engineering. And then from there ended up into structures. And so I've always liked the idea of collaborating, really appreciating artists and architects and making beautiful structures. That's really like what I like to do. I want to make beautiful structures.
I love that. I'm a very similar path in my architectural background, and I just love the idea of putting the form to a beautiful structure. Like, an efficient form is nice. You shared a book recently, Structural Design of Lightweight Architecture, and Zach and I got to read through it, and it is really exciting. So we are going to talk about this. Could you give us the background of the book and a summary sort of before we get in the conversation?
Totally. So the book really is kind of cumulative of sorts. Several years ago, one of my mentors, Chris Studsky, who I worked with for many, many years, up till and including present day, we were talking about several things. And so he recently had retired. And I said, you know, there's just been so much information, so much knowledge in the lightweight architecture and lightweight structures realm that seems really specialized, right? It's not you don't encounter a lot of these in school, these topics, kind of niche, and they're a confluence of lots of specialized knowledge. So the idea was to take the cumulative experience, you know, so my 20 or so years, Chris's years of experience, and synthesize that. The book is not a textbook. The intent is to really, what are the things that you would want to share both on the historical and technical side to get people an entryway into lightweight architecture? And also, what are the key things from a project perspective? So one of the themes of the book is obviously collaboration and working together in teams. And then I think a second and equally important sort of approach of the book is viewing all your constraints as structural constraints. So a lot of times as structural engineers, we think about like strength, we think about deflection, maybe vibration, but increasingly in lightweight structures, there's these ancillary considerations that end up governing. So things like constructability, cost, manufacturing, little things like adding up all your tolerances across a large structure and how you're locking those in. So things like that, that aren't oftentimes in sort of the on the menu of structural design, but end up really, really shaping things. So the book was meant to provide an entryway, kind of entry point for that, and then also be an opportunity to share specific knowledge. So it's hopefully an engaging read, and hopefully there's something you can actually pull from it and apply right away as well. So we tried to do that balancing act.
My flipping through, it seemed like a really nice balance of technical content, but a Petrosky style, like it's actually readable, but it's not quite textbook. It's a very nice in-between that you are learning something, but there's a kind of a background story to the narrative. So I tried to form some questions for this talk here, and I think I had a very hard time putting together questions because this topic is so broad, but we'll see what I ask here. And if any of them are good, this will be excellent, but we'll see what comes out. So my first one, just to kind of set the stage for listeners who don't work with them, I say often, but most of us don't work these ever. How would you define a space frame? This is a big part of the book. And what makes it structurally unique compared to a planar truss? So in these first questions are all in the space frame category. So lead us off.
Yeah, absolutely. Space frame is such a funny moniker because in a lot of ways it's a misnomer. So you hear space frame, and especially if you're not an architect or an engineer, you think space frame, you're like, oh, are we building stuff on Mars or something? So I get that a lot with kind of students and things like that. But so space frame historically is, or I should say space frame is short for what was historically referred to as spatial frameworks. And so they take up space. They're 3D. They're kind of these lattice structures. So you a lot of times you'll see them in airports and public spaces where you're doing large spans. But what a space frame is it's funny because it's neither space nor frame in its actual application. It's a, you know, lattice truss work. And so the actual structural reactions and forces that we're carrying are trusses. So the whole goal, the whole efficiency is that you have these members that are only in tension and compression. So it's really probably better to call it a space truss, but we don't. So it's a space frame is this kind of 3D handling things primarily in tension compression. And that's kind of a theme for lightweight and efficient structures in general, is anytime we can carry load in tension and compression and not bending, that's going to lend itself toward an optimized, efficient lightweight structure. So that's kind of the where that name comes from.
Okay, that makes sense. I'm embarrassed to say I didn't realize it was spatial frame. I maybe would have guessed that, but I just space frame was what it was to me, and I never questioned it.
Yeah.
Oops. Okay. So you already spoke on this a little bit, but just where we might see this in public, you know, in day to day, you said an airport, like a large frame, is there kind of a common building, or are these mostly custom style, unique buildings?
They have their sort of maximal advantage in long spans. So a lot of times you'll see if we're trying to accomplish long span, large span roofs, things like that, airports, sporting events, some more esoteric but super relevant applications would be like these giant telescope structures, which we could talk about later on probably.
Yeah.
And so the idea there is anywhere we really need to have long spans and also that we have the space in our designs for some structural depth. So the idea with a space frame is where they come through or where they derive from is this idea of you've got your platonic solids. So you're thinking like pyramids, tetrahedrals, things like that. And so if you think to, and cubes and octagons and all this kind of stuff. So if you take those, and if instead of looking at those as solids, you basically take the edges and turn those into bars, those then get combined together and those get used in this 3D space. And so in order for them to be maximally efficient, what you need is you need depth to your structure. So One of the reasons we see or we utilize these a lot in these large spans and these open areas is because you get maximal efficiency by having some depth so you can get statics on your side. So you get that effective structural depth, which is much, much, much more robust than just like the actual member depth.
Yeah.
You know better than anyone. One tiny miscalculation can become a huge problem. That's why having the right business insurance matters. Next Insurance is built for structural engineers and small firms and is trusted by over 750,000 small businesses nationwide. You can get tailored professional liability and general liability coverage online in minutes. No endless phone calls or paperwork. Plans start as low as $29 a month. And if you need a certificate of insurance for a new project, you can download it instantly from your phone. Protect your practice so you can focus on building what lasts. Go to nextinsurance.com/SE podcast and get a free quote today.
Okay, so thinking about these things in load path and redundancy, and you mentioned in axial load, it's much more efficient, of course. But in a truss system, it's easier for us to imagine the 2D there is not that much redundancy going on. In a space frame, it's, you know, our truss across three dimensions. How do we think about the redundancy there and then the load path as it does it travel across multiple dimensions, or is this basically trusses like adjacent to each other? How should we think about this?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a beautiful question. So I think we're all familiar with the concept of a traditional two-dimensional truss. And so that's a, you know, it's a one-way spanning beam. We could take that truss, and if we needed to get some more mileage out of it, we could take that truss system and we could run those orthogonal to each other. And so now we have like a gridded truss work system. And so now instead of just spanning one way, we're spanning two ways. And so we get some benefit from that. The key difference between that two-way truss system and the space frame system, and the space frame system, I guess if you don't have a mental image of this, it's almost like if you think of like those models that you dealt with in high school or whatever of like molecules and stuff like that, where you've got these like, you know, you got your atoms and the bonds. And so these systems kind of look like that, where you have these nodes and then these tubes that connect them together. And so the difference between a truss, which is effectively planar, and even if we make a 2D gridded truss system, that's really just 2D systems that are running orthogonal to each other. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the truss system, if you envision that pyramid and that pyramid shape, and we make the edges of that turn into bars, and then we stack those pyramids together, you can now hopefully have a mental picture of the bars in the grid work are not vertical, right? So they're angled in all three directions. Uh-huh. And so that's allowing the forces, you know, forces are kind of like humans where we want to use the quickest path, right? We want to utilize that quickest path. So you cut through, you know, straight from on campus here, you always see it like one building to another. And that's where students, you know,
yes,
get these
the
dirt tracks. Yeah,
yep.
Right. And so forces, loads are just like humans that way. They want to get from one place to another most efficiently. So if we can put some structure there, now instead of having to go straight and turn a corner, now the loads can travel and follow that path through space. And so one of the themes, both in space frames in specific and lightweight structures at large, is the idea of trying to put the material where the load wants to go. And so that's what gives us a lot of that efficiency compared to like a traditional truss system. So that's kind of that layout. Now, in terms of the redundancy is kind of a double-edged sword. So a lot of times, especially nowadays, the idea is we want robust structures, we want redundancy, multiple load paths, all that kind of stuff. With space frames, that's true. And there's some intrinsic redundancy just because you have typically a two-way system by default. And so one of the things you'll do in your design process, of course, is analogous to like, it's FEMA like 427 or something like that, where it's like, hey, progressive collapse, remove a column, see what happens. So basically what you end up with is you do the same kind of process after you've designed that roof or structure to make sure it doesn't collapse. The thing you have to be careful about with these gridded trusses is because you have so many slender elements that you actually don't want to introduce too much redundancy, because every time you introduce more bars and more redundancy, we've got tolerances we have to consider. We've got thermal expansion we have to consider. And so you can actually accidentally introduce a lot of ancillary stresses by introducing unnecessary redundancy. So you walk a pretty fine line there. In terms of the analysis.
So I've got a curiosity here on the formwork of, I wanted to say quick, I keep saying formwork because I'm an engineer, but I mean form as in shape. So we talk about this later, Joshua and I, just so you hear my question correctly, the formwork as in the shape of the structure, space frames, you know, a 2D truss, we've got many varieties to choose from. And then the design is not exactly by just choosing a style like a Warren Howe Pratt. When you're looking at the load going through a space, how are you laying out your space frame? How are you thinking about how it should look? Is this, you gave the example of triangles alternating. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's not exactly how you would lay this out, but how do you think about the force going through this 3D space? Mm-hmm. And I'm having a hard time even putting this question together, but what the form could be. If you know the span you have to cover and the loading, we know that the load would follow the axial path that you give it, but how do you give it the most efficient path?
Yeah, this is where like structural engineering is, you know, a cake or onions or an ogre, right? It has layers, you know, little Shrek reference for you. But when we're looking at this, what we end up doing a lot of times is there's different levels at which we do this analysis. So the first one would be writ large is what is going to be the topology, the overall shape of this structure. So is it going to be kind of like a traditional dome or kind of a billowed pillow-shaped roof? Is it going to be freeform? And incidentally, those are kind of the two places where these structures work best. Is so you typically want at the one extreme rectangular, generally squarish rectangular layouts. That's really maximally efficient. Or at the far end of the extreme, and we just had Frank Gehry passed away, right? So kind of the pinnacle of freeform structures. And so way over on that side, these space frames are really good for that because they can travel and follow those shapes. So typically what you do is you'll do your topology, the overall structural layout of that surface, let's say, and we'll kind of lock that in. And then once we've got that surface that we want that hits our geometry, and nowadays this is a lot of my workflow is like Rhino and Grasshopper, and then eventually I'm moving into, you know, your favorite software and all that kind of stuff for structural analysis. But anyway, once you've got that, then you have these options of what system am I going to use? Space frames are kind of interesting because there are a handful of well-developed companies that have developed these systems. So probably the most famous, one of the, certainly the oldest, is the Marrow system. And I'm a descendant of that lineage. So I go to Chris and Chris goes to Herbert Klimke and Herbert Klimke goes to Max Mengrenhausen, who developed this system over in Germany mid last century. But anyway, you have these systems. And so these systems have nodes and then they have the tubes that kind of connect. And so depending on then I've got the layout of my surface. Now what I need to do is I need to figure out like what's the depth and then what the angles are of those members. And the angles of the members, and the nice part for software nowadays is there's all these rules, these geometric rules that quite frankly, I program in and I filter through all those rules based on the load requirements of the members and the nodes. But a lot of it's geometrically driven based on how big my nodes and my members are going to be. So it's heavy geometry.
Okay. Yeah. So then there could be iterations of geometry with, you know, the rules. How do you fit the rules into the shape that you have available? So for someone that gets to do this style of design, what analysis pitfalls might engineers run into, or would you expect to be common, especially with nodal stiffness and connection assumptions?
Yeah, space frames are really interesting, I think, because they lend themselves so well to our software nowadays, right? So every maybe not everyone, but many of the people listening had to do matrix methods or matrix analysis at some point in school. And certainly all the software we use is driven by linear algebra and matrix analysis. So the good news is space frames were made for that because they're nodes and they're elements. And so that's really, really, really efficient. I think one of the challenges increasingly is that, and this is, again, specific to space frames, but broader in general, is that as the software gets more and more sophisticated and we can do more and more of our thinking and iterating in there, it becomes very seductive to engineers to spend your time in the software. And so that can start to drive the designs instead of coming to the software with good designs. And so that can be a challenge. I think analogous to that is we've got these software systems that can do so much that it's really important that you know what all the different buttons do. Am I doing first order analysis, second order analysis, inelastic, elastic? And again, this is a theme with kind of all lightweight structures. So a lot of this gets simplified by programming nowadays because you can script things, you can keep track of your nodes, you can keep track of your elements. The efficiency of the system really comes down to having reproducibility. So if I've got this giant space frame, the goal for me is to have one node size and one member size. Maybe I change that a little bit. And so in order to do that and keep track of everything, I have thousands, tens of thousands of nodes. And so it's a lot of data. And so that can be overwhelming to engineers unless you're thinking about things in first principles and then managing your data in light of that and not just jumping into software and trying to let the computer do everything? Because I feel like that's a common pitfall, right?
Yes.
In all things. Yeah.
That's my favorite pitfall to fall into. So you mentioned tolerances and especially, you know, key movement of nodes. How would you coordinate tolerances and fabrication with the architect and fabricator? There's just a lot of nodes going on here, and we could plot this out in the software and get exactly right on with this. But in 3D real life, it can be a little bit harder. Have you found any way that efficiently, that makes the design a little more efficient for construction?
Mm-hmm. I think if you're engaging in space frames or any lightweight structure, it's important in the design team to have some experience, which is a little chicken and egg, like how do you get the experience if you haven't done it before? Da, da, da.
Yep.
But having someone who has that past experience really helps bring those kind of real world realities and the construction tolerances into view. So from a manufacturing perspective, you know, even 20, 30 years ago, the manufacturing tolerances were remarkably tight. So a lot of it really became driven by construction tolerances and as we're erecting this in the field, not so much you can design it in your software, you know, to the thousandth decimal place. And then actually you can machine it pretty efficiently as well. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of it becomes what often gets left out of the equation is the contractor or the erector. And so the skill there is just invaluable for having, and that's where the cost is either going to be super efficient or it's going to explode. So I think tolerances between engineers and manufacturers, and again, out in industry that can overlap. Certain companies are out there, they'll do the engineering and the manufacturing, but that's pretty well on the same wavelength. I think the key thing is bringing in your contractor, your erector, and making sure they know how to do this and really talk through what those tolerances look like, because they are very, very tight. And also, though, if you think about these space frames and also grid shells, these lightweight structures, you'll have hundreds or thousands of nodes over a span. And so even very, very small tolerances build up when you multiply it by 1,000. And so that's where we were talking earlier, is this like trade-off with like redundancy and tolerances and things like that. You really have to be careful, because you can appreciate, I think, that we're not talking about a standard steel sort of frame where we're able to, you know, grab an eighth inch here, you know, rack that column so that we can get it bolted in. And then move on to the next bay without any like downstream impacts. Whereas, you know, due to the lattice work of these structures, you're accruing, you're aggregating that along the way. So the good news is, from a design and fabrication perspective, we've got that pretty well honed in. A lot of where the rubber meets the road is really going to be in terms of the construction. And so having someone who knows what they're doing is always valuable for all things. but in this case is really, really, really valuable.
And I'm sure having them on the team very early and just having these discussions of erection.
Yeah. Yeah. That was definitely a theme, right? Is like, if you can bring the team together early, that's absolutely clutch in these types of projects.
Okay. The next couple questions I have for you are on cable nets, which you could are very similar to a space frame in some respects. Maybe, we'll see. I'll skip the trying to pair those together. Let's just get to the question. Can you describe a cable net structure? It behaves differently from conventional systems. How do you explain the structural behavior and explain this, especially to clients and architects when looking at the project?
Mm-hmm. Cable nets are, I think, my favorite lightweight system, which is like you're picking among children here or something.
Yeah.
And so I think probably the most famous would be the Olympic Stadium in Munich, Fry Otto's, like, just, and he, incidentally, I think we celebrated the 100th anniversary. Obviously he has passed away, but, we celebrated the 100th anniversary of his birth. So his 100th birthday was this year, I think, in May. But anyway,
cool.
So cable net structures are really, I think they're such a beautiful, innovative structure. And also they have this, like, again, these extremes where, on the one hand, when you're learning statics in college, a cable is about as easy as it gets. It carries, right? Like, cut the free body, tension in the cable, boom, done, right? And so axial axial, no compression. It's as simple as it gets. And so on the one hand, we literally take cables, right? And we stretch those out. The everyday examples of this would be things like, you know, your spider webs. But even better than that would be like tennis rackets. The tennis racket is the best example out there of what a cable net structure is predicated on. You have all these strings, they're tensioned, and then they get anchored to a compression ring at the perimeter. And that's fundamentally what we've got going on there. So, you know, oftentimes I'll walk people through the idea of if you've got, you know, birds on a wire was really popular for a while there. It was like this Angry Birds. Angry Birds or whatever. Yeah. And so, and then, or slacklining is another one. So you've got this, like, the famous example, which is another just random structural shout out, is so between the two towers, and not Lord of the Rings, but the World Trade Center, right?
Yes.
So the World Trade Center buildings, back when they were under construction, in like 1974, there's this, and he's still around today, Philippe Petit, and he walked between the two towers, right? There's a movie, there's also a kid's book, Between Two Towers, which is great. But anyway, so if you take a cable and you tie it to two trees or two towers or whatever, when you go and you apply a load in the middle, what does the cable do? Well, it's going to deflect, right? And really, no matter how tightly you winch that cable down, when you step out in the middle of that cable, it's going to deflect some amount. Yeah. So we've got several things at play here. So we're going to, you know, things get more complicated because they're not just the cable with the tension. So now we've got cable with the tension, and now it's going to have a load. Obviously, the more tension we have in the cable, the less it deflects. But there's always going to be some deflection. And the deflecting is actually what lets it engage to resist the load. So for cable nets, we're in a totally different world now, right? So like when we were over in space frames, when we're designing them for like telescopes, for example, my deflection for space frames could be as little as L over 5,000.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, when we move over to cable nets, our deflections can be like L over 30.
Yeah, not putting gypsum on your cable net.
no gypsum. But that's actually a really good point, because what do we usually put on cable nets? We put glass on cable nets, which is also very brittle.
Yes.
And so a lot of the design, and we can talk about this more if you want, a lot of the design criteria associated with cable nets is actually driven by the glass design, right? So the cables are going to deflect a whole bunch, and then that's going to influence whatever you clad it with. But anyway, so cable nets are, you know, fundamentally you've got this net of cables. So this is not, you know, this is what it's called. It's a net of cables. It's pre-stressed. And then the design there is to carry loads out of plane. So you're pre-stressing in plane to carry loads out of plane.
Okay. Yeah. The form of this version, what is the workflow to form finding here? Especially, you know, compared to the space frame, or not even compared, just how do you go about finding an appropriate form and an efficient form?
So in my context, there's two typical applications for cable nets. So you'll have kind of the cable net roof structures like we talked about with the Olympic Stadium in Munich. And then there'll be what I design primarily is cable net structures, which are usually used for walls, for facades. And so for those applications, you have a handful of types of cable nets to choose from. So you can have one-way spanning cables, where you imagine you have a cable that gets tied into the slab at the bottom. You get a cable that gets tied up to the top and it gets tensioned. And then the horizontal cables are just there to effectively hang the glass off of the vertical cable. Then you could have horizontal cables. And so you can have horizontal cables that are actually tensioned, and just like a Christmas tree or whatever, you hang the glass off those horizontal cables, or you stack the glass so that it's actually bearing gravity, and now the cables are just there to do the out of plane. And then the last one is the two-way spanning. So the reason I mentioned those different types of cable nets is because the approach you'll do to the design depends a little bit on the type of cable mat. A good example that gives you probably the most flexibility or the most design freedom. So a lot of times architects and artists want to have these curved walls and you want to have large spans and all this kind of stuff is, well, we talked about earlier how a cable wants to deflect. There's no matter how much tension you put into the cable, it's going to deflect. So one really effective strategy is to say, okay, well, I'm going to let the cable deflect, just like a piece of paper, right? If you have a piece of paper and it's spanning between two books, it can't carry anything. If all of a sudden you put a crease in there, now it's got geometric stiffness. So if I take the cable net and I allow it to deflect the way it would deflect, so I'm talking you through this design now. Mm-hmm. So I had a flat cable net wall. Well, what's going to happen when the wind blows on the wall? It's going to deflect. It's going to get concave. So if I take the load from the wind and I apply it there, and then I freeze that load, right? So that deflection under that load, if I freeze that and I grab that, now all of a sudden I've got this curved shape. And if I run my cables in the horizontal direction to tension those to lock that shape in, now I've got intrinsic, it's a very, very stiff system. So I've absorbed that deflection and now all my loads can get transferred directly by my cables. So that's a pretty common approach. You know, in the book we talk this through. So anyone who's flown through SeaTac, the lobby of SeaTac is this giant cable net wall that that we go to in into detail in the book on, and that's how that was done. So it's doubly curved and we lock in that wind load to get the stiffness so that now we can use the cables to their maximum effect.
Interesting. Just curious in the book, and I don't think I saw this, the Denver airport, is that in there with the, as sort of a roof?
The membrane kind of?
Yeah, the membrane roof there.
Everything that we included in the book is a project we worked on. And that was very intentional.
Okay, cool. I don't think I read
it. Yeah. So everything we include in the book is something we worked on. And that was so that we could talk about the details, right? And, you know, we talked about the good and the bad. So it's like, hey, we did this. And then if you ever had based on what we learned from this project, here's what I would, you know, here's what we'd do the next time. And actually in the cable net chapter in particular, we kind of go through this chronologically where we have, you know, we have a sort of light wall installation in Seattle that we did with an artist, James Carpenter. Mm-hmm. And then we did the SeaTac airport, and then we did a bunch of cable nets in Chicago. And so the neat part about that is you can see as we iterate through those, and they were some of the earliest ones in North America, as we iterate through those, things get more and more sophisticated. So I think that Chris always mentions this when we're talking about the book, that like the book is not the end all be all. It's a snapshot mm-hmm. in time, and it's meant to be as transparent, no pun intended, as possible to share, like, here's all this information, because the rate at which lightweight structures evolves is much faster than a lot of other areas of structural engineering. Yes. So everything in the book is something that we worked on.
That's extremely exciting. I skipped that, or in my quick read through, didn't realize that there are a lot of structures in that book. So I just thought that was not the case. That's very impressive. Okay, so let's going back to the cable nets here. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar-ish with a cable in tension. If you play guitar, mm-hmm. it makes a lot of noise, right? How do you look at wind-induced vibration in a cable structure? I mean, I'm sure there is vibration. Is that an issue, or are we our frequency low enough that it isn't that big of a problem?
Yeah. You see, you're cooler than I am. I play the banjo.
So
guitar's way cooler than the banjo. But that makes a ton of sense. And I think that's a hyper relevant discussion when you're designing cables for like cabled stayed bridges. And, you know, we all know these sort of, you get wind, you get vortex shedding, those kinds of things. Increasingly with cable net structures, they get clad. And so the vibration, and so now that said, vibration from like a seismic perspective is hugely relevant. So again, going back to the SeaTac airport, so that's in Seattle, it was a high seismic area. And so one of the ways that we dealt with that in that project was we had these giant wind loads and we had these giant seismic forces. So what do you do? Well, we needed stiffness built in or baked into the system. And so that's where we ended up with that anticlastic double curvature. Okay. Now, sometimes you don't always have that, right? And so sometimes to do that would not cohere with the artist or the architect's vision. And so then what you're constrained to is pre-stress forces. And this is suboptimal, but it still works. So, all right, we got to increase our tension, our pre-stress on those cables. There's at least two impacts that you have to consider when you do that. At some point, more pre-stress means your cables have to get bigger. And there's an iterative, we could talk that through there, because it's cables are unlike other steel where they're nonlinear in behavior. So you get larger cables, you get larger forces, and you can have a little bit of chasing your tail there. And also, just like a tennis racket, or your guitar is a better example, right? You keep adding pre-stress, and until it breaks, right? So you have to pay attention to the cable itself, but then also, I have an old banjo, and you see that one of my banjos is relatively old. It's like, been tensioned for 50 years. And you'll see that the neck of the banjo has actually started to curve over time, right? And so you could imagine that if you never tuned your guitar or your banjo and the neck starts to curve, you lose the pre-stressing.
Yep.
And so as we introduce more and more pre-stress into the structure, it becomes much, much more important to check those boundary elements to make sure that they're stiff enough that they're not deflecting, that you're not losing your pre-stress. There's a bunch of examples where, the pre-stress is really one of the things you have to pay attention to. You have to test, you test it when you install it, you come back, you test it a little bit later, and you really want to watch that, because if you lose the pre-stress, there goes the system, right?
Yeah. Is there a reasonable amount of creep or relaxation? Like you mentioned, the guitar neck bending upwards, does the cable relax in our case? So the neck going the other way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, both and. So the cables are interesting because they're made out of steel strand, but they're not like the typical steel we encounter in, hot rolled steel or whatever, where you've got a constant E. So your modulus of elasticity is actually, it varies with the loading. So what cable manufacturers will do is they'll preload. And as you get to a point, and if you've ever and you've experienced this. So when you take a rubber band and you very first stretch it, it's like, it's really easy to stretch. And then it gets to a point where the more and more you apply a load, the harder it is to stretch it. So cables are very similar to that, where like once you apply, you can get pseudo linear behavior once you've applied enough load, but it's a nonlinear behavior in the cable itself.
That sounds so exciting. Actually, I did not think about this, but gosh,
yeah.
Okay. Would you say are some important considerations when detailing cable anchorage and the edge beams, the compression side of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so just kind of what we were just talking about, and then also for this. So ASCE 19 is a really good reference for cables in general. So whatever you're using cables for, it has really good conversation there. It also talks about different ways you can connect those. So typically, you've got two styles of connectors, and depending on which one of those you're using, you have different modification factors and things like that. So you can pay attention to that in your design. The other thing we want to do for our load path is we want to make sure that as we're tracking our load through, imagine you've got this spider web, this cable net, right? So as we're tracking our load from the glass pane to the cable net, to the main cable, to the connection, to the supporting structure, we want to make sure that we have consistent levels of safety factors throughout. And so that comes into detail again when you're doing these connections with your load factors and things like that, which you can find in ASCE 19.
Okay.
I would say the real detailing comes into two areas. It's where we're actually connecting to the substructure. So in lightweight structures in general, oftentimes lightweight structures are a substructure within a larger structure. So you're doing your structural analysis in these lightweight structures, but eventually you have to talk, right, to the main structure. And so at some point we have to tie back in. And so these perimeter beams, these floors, we have to make sure that those are both stiff enough and strong enough to handle those loads. And so the anchorage forces and the detailing there is really important. And again, this is why collaboration really matters, because you can't have a successful lightweight project where you just like have maybe the facade consultant hand it off and say like, all right, here's your reactions, go do your thing, EOR. You really need a dialogue back and forth. And a lot of these projects will actually end up, even though it's not in our scope, quote unquote, we'll model a good chunk of the whole building to get what the actual stiffnesses are. Because if you overestimate the stiffness of the structure that you're tying into, that direct, especially for cable nets, that directly impacts things. Yeah. So the connection design is really important. You know, from a load perspective, a lot of times we're getting really large loads in the anchorage from these cables. So that's, you know, not trivial. But the design of that's pretty typical engineering. A lot of sort of the magic happens in making sure we've got our stiffnesses that are what we thought they would be and that are actually compatible with the forces. And again, a lot of that nowadays is done really easily. We can iterate through that or iterate over that in software where a lot of this is iterative. You're doing incremental load applications.
Interesting. I can imagine that the formwork is so sensitive to the stiffness of the structure that it's tied to that you may end up with a shape that not fitting exactly what you expected if the supporting structure is much more flexible and things are not held tightly.
Yeah. Well, and actually, and this is both for cable nets and oftentimes for membranes. Mm-hmm. There's not formwork per se. So a lot of this is we'll design the cables. So in their length and in their tensioning, that's how we get. So again, construction sequencing is really important here.
Yep.
So if we've got this net, they're designed to, and also as we add pre-stress to the cables, they elongate. So we work with the manufacturers to get we do the calcs to get this all designed so that here are the cables. We're going to lay them out. Then we're going to tension them. And we're trying to predict that as we pre-tension them, they're going to grow to this length. But in that tensioning, that's what locks in the shape. So if you have like a curve that you want to do, what you'll do is you'll go ahead and you'll do one direction of cable and you'll get that hung. Then you'll come in with the other direction. So that the first direction is slack. And it's kind of like blowing up. Like, can you imagine taking a balloon and blowing it up inside of, like, you know, the mesh that oranges come in, that mesh bag oranges come in?
Yes.
So as you blow up the balloon in the mesh bag, right, it's going to inflate and it's going to tension the mesh and then it's going to like extrude forth. And we'll talk about this when we get to membranes as well. But it's that idea of in your geometry, that's what's going to create this, and in your construction sequencing. Yeah.
Interesting. Sorry, I meant by formwork, I meant the architectural definition of that. Like, but that answer was
cut that
really
whole
good.
Thing. Then. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I don't know, but I like everything you said, I really like. So I might just
fixed.
Ta-da. I got one last question here for you on cable nets. Do you expect, this is my very opinion, but do you see cable nets becoming more common with the advanced analysis tools, or are they still a little too niche for most projects, right?
I think the ubiquity of all these lightweight structures is growing. And I think that's in part because as our sort of software abilities grow, it's easier to do the design. It becomes far more tractable. Mm-hmm. I think what really is going to be the governing decision on cable nets is not so much the analysis, but it really does become a design feature and a cost consideration. So a lot of the times you see cable net walls in particular is because there's a desire to really minimize the structure. So oftentimes where cable net walls come into play is like, do we want to get rid of mullions so that we get a maximally transparent sort of facade? And so I think it's a little bit less so around the structural capacity, because there's a lot of firms out there who can and do this. I think a lot of it's really driven on the client side or the architecture side of like when it makes sense, right? Because space frames can be really, really efficient compared to traditional steel in where they are. Cable nets are a very lightweight structure, but like cable net walls in particular for like glass and glazing, those are oftentimes you have to work really hard in the design team to drive the cost to be competitive with like a traditional glazed storefront system and things like that. So it's really what's the vision of the project, and that's usually what drives these things.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens in the future. But now we're going to move on to ETFE membranes. They've become very popular recently. The Zach and I did an episode about our favorite projects in the last couple of years. The Shed was by Doran Tomasetti did, and that's high on my list. What would you say makes these so attractive from a structural and architectural perspective? And I don't know, where do you see this growth going? Do you think it'll continue? Do you think this will be a much more common building material?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, before I do that, the Shed is in the book, actually.
Oh, yeah.
So that's what so that's one of the ones we looked at. And it's kind of a small world, obviously. And I think that highlights, too, how these teams work. So there's a lot of people you bring together on a team for these lightweight structures. Oftentimes, you have an awesome EOR like Thornton Tomasetti, and then there'll be subcontractors typically. And then those subcontractors will oftentimes hire specialty engineers, facade engineers, to work with the contractor to make this work. So this is a lot of times these design packages are sort of delegated through that way. But yeah, ETFE is amazing. I feel like it's a material that is a long time in coming. It's been around for quite some time. The advantages of ETFE are that it's actually lightweight, right? So we just got to talking about glass. Glass just looks lightweight. ETFE is remarkably lightweight. And then it has all these additional benefits. So it's really great for UV. It has a wonderful acoustic as well, if you're designing for it in the right space. So you've got all these sort of benefits. It lets light through, but not, you know, it's not transparent, it's translucent. Mm-hmm. So you've got all these different kinds of things. So ETFE is really neat because it's truly, truly lightweight. And in the history of membrane structures, if you go back a long way, and there's one in my backyard here. So the 1974 Expo was hosted in Spokane, and they have this giant kind of tent-like cable structure, which was clad initially with like a kind of canvas sort of thing. And those just don't last as well, right? So they don't last that long. There's canvas, then there was like PVC kind of plastic that also doesn't hold up very well for under UV. And so this structure was clad a couple times, twice actually, and then like it lasted like 2 or 3 years and they gave up because they're like, this isn't worth it, right? So ETFE is really novel because it has really good UV sort of resilience. So it's lightweight, it's highly resilient, and it lets you design really long spans that are actually really light.
And the UV resilience, are we talking 10 years or 50? Like, you know, what is the scale here? Because I expect this style of material wouldn't be very good, but I don't have any perspective. My perspective is plastics and PVC.
Yeah. Right, so. And I always think back to like the like, you know, 5 mil plastic you see on construction sites and all that kind of stuff. And and so this is like fundamentally different at like the molecular, I'm no chemist, but at the molecular level or whatever. So it's a different plastic. So it's really robust that way. And then the other thing too, is that the manufacturers who create ETFE and those products, like every year, they're just getting better and better and better and better. And so you can expect, increasingly, like many things in life, you get what you pay for. And so you can buy higher end ETFE membranes that are going to last, you know, instead of the 5 to 10 years, the 20 to 50 years or whatever it's going to be. And they're really quite robust that way.
Okay, I want to ask this about structural spanning here, and I've never used ETFE. I know very, very little about this, but structural considerations, you know, if you're spanning some distance, what goes behind choosing and what are the options available? So I had looked up like there's a single layer and multi-layer ETFE, but that's as far as I know here that you can have multiple layers. What are we looking at for spanning and what is the span distance that we can expect and... Yeah, had the support of this.
Maybe it'd be useful to back up for a second and talk about ETFE and how we use it.
Yeah.
So ETFE foils or layers that we'd call it, right, is kind of what you'd envision, like these sheets of plastic. When we're talking about lightweight structures and structural applications, a lot of times what we're talking about are like ETFE pillows. And so what you'll oftentimes do is you'll take the ETFE and you make giant bubble wrap, right? Mm. So we inflate it, and then that's what gives the structural capacity. So it's not so much that we're taking Saran wrap and, you know, putting it over our Tupperware. It's much more so that we've got this kind of bubble wrap. And so by inflating that structure, we're able to go through and get the pressure vessel kind of analysis. So you get the pressure that then that pressure gives you some geometric benefit, because now instead of just this thin sheet, we've got this bubble wrap, which has mm-hmm. a volume and an internal pressure to it. And then you can imagine as you inflate a basketball, as you inflate anything, as you have that internal pressure, that gives you kind of a global stability as well. So that's one way. So typically in my experience, when I'm dealing with ETFE, it's inflated pillow structures, not just flat sheets. There are applications for that, like greenhouses and things like that. But uh-huh. if we're trying to get larger spans, then we're getting those inflated ones. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. What are, since I've just made a confused moment here, is what are other common misconceptions that people have about ETFE? Durability, fire performance, energy performance is what's like coming to my head here.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how to speak to that. In like the popular zeitgeist or something like that.
Well, how about this? I give you like, I expect it has very low fire capabilities. Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, let's do it this way. And you can correct me or not. Maybe energy performance, I would expect fairly good if you have mm-hmm. a two-layer system, a single layer, it's probably not great. And actually, I'm curious on the weight of this. You mentioned it was far lighter than glass. I'm wondering, do you know the density or have like a comparison that we can have in our heads?
Yes, it's in chapter 5 of the book. I don't have it memorized. But so on that though, glass, you know, the density of glass is equal to that of concrete. So glass is super dense. You know, you're looking at about 150 PCF. ETFE's density, like if you had a chunk of ETFE and a chunk of glass, I think it's like, I don't know, maybe a third or a quarter. So it's decidedly less dense. Where you really get the benefit is when you're looking at like an insulated glass unit, you've got two panes of eighth inch glass. When I'm looking at ETFE membranes, I'm looking at like a couple mils of thickness. So one, you get the benefit of the density, and then two, you're just using a lot less of the material, which is also useful when we're looking at like sustainability and embodied carbon and energy. From that perspective, you're just using less material. And so that's really beneficial as well. So that's helpful from a sustainability. Your R values are really high because you've got these giant inflated, you know, air cushions. And so that gives you some benefit there as well. I think, yeah, in terms of perceptions, it's probably because historically there were these membranes that didn't age well, that were potentially prone to fire, things like that. ETFE and other modern membranes has some of that baggage to sort of unload because the modern materials are, you know, UL listed, they're flame retardant, they're all these things. They're really resilient, and they don't have some of the shortcomings that some of the historic sort of membranes had.
Interesting. You mentioned some of this here, but just thinking on my closing on ETFE, because especially, you know, I'm less familiar with here. Are there any main or long-term performance concerns that owners should be aware of? And, you know, I know you've talked on a lot of this, but just give me a final.
Well, let me share my, like, I didn't know, right? when I was the one of the first ones we were working on, and I remember it was like halfway through that I started thinking about like, what happens when, if it gets a hole in it, does it pop like a balloon kind of thing? Like mentally, as a young engineer, I was like, if this gets a hole, like how do you, it must be really strong because otherwise it just pops or whatever. And actually tears and holes in ETFE don't propagate. And I didn't know that. So what you'll actually find is birds really love ETFE, which is kind of a bummer. So they'll a lot of times they'll land on it and they'll kind of peck at it and poke it and all this kind of stuff. And so the good news is that those, you know, it's not popping like a balloon. The downside, of course, is that as birds and different things will aggregate on this, you'll pick up more holes. And so what that means is the better analogy might be, instead of it being bubble wrap, it's like those inflatables that you have at Christmas or whatever. So an ETFE roof structure has pumps that are constantly keeping the internal pressure up. And so what happens over time is if you get losses in the system, you might have to up the sort of pump pressure and, you know, to make up for those a little bit. But it's, and I didn't expect this, but it's relatively negligible. So one sort of misnomer or misunderstanding I had was this idea of like, oh, if you poke it, it'll tear or pop or it's going to rip and fall down. But it doesn't have that. And then I think the other one that I did have as well was like, to me, I was like, how do you talk about this being super sustainable when you're running pumps all the time to keep this pressurized? And it's really, it's a really interesting sort of subset that falls out of structural engineering, but the process, these pumps actually to deliver the pressure, because we're not talking like, you know, hundreds or thousands of PSI, right? It's just enough to keep it pressurized. They're actually remarkably low energy. And the benefits that you gain from, you know, the insulation value and all this other kind of stuff, you know, it more than makes up for having to run pumps to keep them inflated this whole time.
What is, and this is a weird number, but what is the scale of the pressure? You do like a PSI or you may even say, is this bike tire or car tire or?
Yeah, it's I just don't have that one memorized. We're going to have to edit that out. I don't know.
Also, put it right here. 600 pascals. It's less than one PSI. The scale is hard. 600 feels like a big number. It's a bike tire when it has a hole in it. Okay. But I'm very curious because I thought it was much stiffer, like a very low pressure just to kind of keep it. But I've never had experience here. Just looking at the readups I've done on the shed, like it looks amazing. But I hard to imagine what exactly is going with the pressure. But I'll come back to
that. What I would say is the pressure analysis is the nice part about ETFE membranes is the pressure analysis can be done with some efficiency by hand as a first pass. So there's some hand calcs in the book. Both the examples we use, one of which is the new-ish Viking Stadium, so the U.S. Bank Stadium, and then the second one is the shed. Both of those systems use cables with ETFE. And so what you'll do is you'll do some hand calcs to get some initial pressure. But we already talked about the nonlinearity of cables. And so the nonlinearity of cables plus the contact surfaces, again, you end up doing iterative analysis to kind of figure out what those pressures need to be, both in the ETFE and in the cables.
Okay. I've got a couple big picture questions that might tie us all together here. First is the digital engineering. We've talked about software here, but parametric modeling, nonlinear, digital fabrication, how are these things changing what is possible and how frequently we might see these systems?
Yeah, I'm going to lump us together. In our career, it's been amazing to see the development of technology. Yep. And I think the advantages of that is how quickly you can ideate through things. Lightweight structures really do benefit from that tremendously because there is a lot of iterative analysis. There's a lot of nonlinearity that you encounter. And so by picking up efficiencies just in computational power and the ability to do parametric analysis, what it's allowing us to do is do projects that wouldn't have been as obvious candidates for lightweight structures in the past because it would have been computationally prohibitive.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of benefit from that there. I also think, too, what it does is it takes the structural designer and the design team now has to be able, though, to really have a good sense of foundational principles and fundamentals. So what really becomes important for the engineer is when I'm doing a design charrette with the architect or the artist or the contractor or whatever, I can't have to rely on going back to my computer and running, you know, an hour of simulation or whatever. Yeah. So having the intrinsic knowledge and understanding of like how things actually react to loads, I think is only going to become increasingly more valuable. And then I think what we're able to do is able to outsource a lot of the iterative design to, you know, Python scripting and parametric analysis and things like that. So it's kind of like I don't have to spend as much time at the rock pile just chipping away at this.
Yes.
You can really think in terms of what it does is it frees you up to think in terms of systems and come up with better global solutions, you know.
Interesting. Yes, that's fun way to think about it. I don't want to make you choose a favorite project here, but what project touched you the most, let's say, about pushing the limits of lightweight structures?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like picking among your children here. We mentioned that. I think because of the final product and also the symmetry of the structure to its intent, we did a canopy, a glass canopy, outside of the Brooklyn Academy for Music. And so the Brooklyn Academy for Music is this wonderful kind of Cream City brick style classical architecture out in Boston. And it has housed the arts for many, many, many years. So music, all this other kind of stuff. And so in that, we were retained to come up with this, it's this undulating kind of serpentine glass and hollow structural steel canopy outside the structure. So it's kind of this like Janus faced kind of approach where you have the traditional brick and then you have this hyper modern sleek canopy. And the reason I like it so much is because we really worked in tandem with the architect to come up with a design that was this flowing sort of sculpture that evoked the sense of like kind of music flowing across the page. And then what we did was we used the glass. So instead of having the structure, the steel structure that just supports the glass and the glass's infill, what we ended up doing is the glass actually becomes the part of the structural load path. So you have this tension and compression load path and you have the glass in there. Okay. But now going back to our discussion about robustness and multiple load paths and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. What? So glass breaks. So it probabilistically fails. So what happens when one of those pieces of glass fails? Well, we ended up going in and we use these Belleville washers. And so these flat washers that you can tension in plane. And so what was really neat is we used those for two reasons. One, that let us get the appropriate amount of tension between the glass and the steel structure statically. Also, what the washers allow us to do is when or if a piece of glass breaks, what you don't want is you don't want one piece of glass to break and that kind of jar all the rest and you have a domino effect, right? This unzippering. And so what we ended up doing was we ended up like tuning these washers, right? Like you would tune a guitar or a piano or whatever. So we ended up tuning the structural system so that we got this nice undulating system on the outside of this music hall that had been around for 100 years or whatever. And so I like the story behind that I thought was really nice because it's this idea of how the structure can be much more than, or it can add to the story and the architecture and the art really of what you've got going on.
That sounds amazing. Well, I got a final one for you, and I'm going to look up photos of this that building that you just mentioned. But where do you see the future of lightweight, transparent, long-span systems heading? What do you think we have ahead of us?
I think we have more. So we've talked about as software is increasingly extending our capacity to be able to design and iterate and be much more sophisticated in our solutions. I think that's helpful. I think also lightweight structures, when they're the optimal solution to the design problem in front of us, lend themselves to being remarkably efficient and sustainable. And so as we're trying to be more efficient, both in terms of actual energy over the course of a building and also embodying energy, it lets us really rethink optimality from a structural perspective. Now, that's not true for every building everywhere, but where they are the solution, they are oftentimes, you know, the answer in terms of sustainability and efficiency, and I'll argue beauty and aesthetics. And so I think that as we have these tools more and more available, and hopefully, quite frankly, one of the goals of the book was to try to take knowledge that you kind of hitherto could only learn by working at one of these specialty firms. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to bring that knowledge out into the marketplace of ideas so that engineers who maybe don't have the opportunity to work at these can start to dissect this, use the software, use the resources that are out there and enter into this, right? The idea is to have this more and more accessible for designers and then ultimately in the built environment.
That's perfect and very exciting. So we're going to thank you so much for talking to me today. I really enjoy this. And we're going to link everything so people can find the book and find any resources about you. Thanks so much. It was great talking.
Hey, thanks, Max.
Well, that's a wrap on today's conversation with Joshua, where we dove into the world of space frames, cable nets, and ETFE membranes, and explored how these expressive structural solutions reshape the way engineers think about load paths, geometry, and collaboration. If you're a structural engineer, the takeaway is clear. These systems aren't just visually striking. They demand a deeper level of integration, thinking three-dimensionally, coordinating early with architects and fabricators, and understanding the unique behaviors of these materials and geometries can put you in a position to influence projects in a powerful way. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Structural Engineering Podcast. Be sure to check out the links and resources in the show notes and join us for structural trivia to keep your skills sharp. Until next time, keep learning, keep building, keep engineering a better future.